Andrew.
What's up?
Andrew does all of our everything.
We're good?
You are the man. Okay. Just quickly, if we can, just you'll see one of the things that make people happy are meeting other people, remembering their names. So just really quickly, let's run around our names, please. Kayla. And if you're actually here for the first time, just tell me your last name also. Klein. Welcome, Kayla. Welcome, Izzy.
I'm Gail.
Hello, Gail.
I'm Lindsay Bernard.
Excellent. Welcome. Bernard. Sharon Brenner. Okay. Sharon, where are you from? Brooklyn. Beautiful. Okay. It is. Leia, where are you from? But where's your family from?
Oh, Azerbaijan.
Very nice. Beautiful. Welcome. Welcome. Felicia, nice to see you again. Okay. Felicia. Okay. Please. I'm sorry?
Carol.
Welcome, Carol. Pleasure to have you here.
My name is Ksenia.
Ksenia, what's your last name? Sorry.
Bielkina.
Bielkina, okay.
So.
That's fine. That's close enough. Casina. Very nice.
Jeremy
Scharf. Where are you from, Jeremy? Very nice. Welcome. What's your last name, Mike? Kimato. Where are you from? Queens. Where?
Corona.
Corona, sure. Okay, cool. Pleasure to have you. William. Welcome back, William. And over here?
Stanford.
Nice to have you.
Matt.
Welcome back, Matt. Nice to have you here. Welcome, welcome. You could pull up a seat right here if you like. And what's your name? Sarid, welcome. Hello. Nice to have you back, Sarid. And hello, Miranda.
Hello.
Welcome. Oh, right here, please. What's your name?
Marcus.
Marcus. Pleasure. Marcus. Okay, great. So let me tell you a story that is going to sort of bring us into this topic. I just turned it off. Okay, give me a second. Welcome, everyone. Pleasure. Sorry it's cold out. And we have the air conditioning on. Do we need the air conditioning on? It's Manhattan, so the... No, I'm just going to turn it off. Hang on. Okay. If you get, hello, welcome. If you get, let's get you, you can just pull up a seat, sure. Nice to see you. What's your name?
Jacob.
Jacob, welcome, Jacob. If you get hot, just let me know. I don't think you will. So this is a story that took place a while ago, but not so long ago, in the 1950s, actually. There was a Dr. Stuart Wolfe, who was the head of University of Oklahoma's Department of Medicine, okay? And he went to this little rural town called Rosetta, Pennsylvania, to deliver a lecture, a talk, to and he finished his medical talk, and he went out to get a beer with a couple of the local doctors that sat in on his lecture. And the doctors... told, they were just schmoozing, I don't know, shooting the breeze. And they told Wolf that one of the doctors said that in his 17 years of practicing medicine in Rosetta, he rarely found anyone under the age of 65 with heart disease. Now, that might not sound so crazy today, but back in the 1950s, when heart disease was like an epidemic in the United States, that was like a crazy thing for a doctor or anyone to hear, okay? Andrew, want to do me a favor? Welcome, guys. Can you bring in a couple of extra seats? We actually ran out of seats. Just bring some in if you don't mind. Thanks. And so as I mentioned, this was, you know, heart attacks were very, very common in folk. Actually, they used to call them husband killers because they were affecting a lot of men in their 40s and 50s. And it was a big deal. And to find out that no one under the age of 65 had heart disease, or it was rare, was like a very, very weird thing to hear from a doctor that seemed to be in the know. So anyway, Wolf called in some of his colleagues and medical students from the university, and they began an extensive study. It was actually the most studied city in the United States ever. It was a very, very comprehensive study. They brought in researchers, medical researchers and psychological researchers. They took blood samples, they brought in sociologists, and they conducted a very extensive study throughout the entire population. It was a small town, so it wasn't difficult to do. And here's what they discovered. They found that in this tiny, small, rural town, most of the people lived until a ripe old age. Early, sudden, or premature death was virtually unheard of. And again, in the 1950s, before any of the cholesterol-lowering drugs that we thankfully have today, heart attacks were just very, very common. There was almost no heart disease. Also, no suicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and virtually no crime. It was a very boring place to live, but there was like no issues. And by the way, also, nobody was on welfare. Everybody had a job. So the question is, what accounted for this healthier lifestyle? And they began to rule out, that's what researchers do, they rule out factors. First, they looked at diet, and they noticed that the people of Rosetta shared the same unhealthy dieting and exercise habits of the surrounding towns, meaning people didn't diet very much. This is the 1950s. Nobody was running. People were not as health conscious in this country. 41% of the people in Rosetta's calorie intake was from fat. They regularly cooked with lard. Nobody was like doing yoga or jogging every day. Many of them smoked heavily and struggled with obesity. And yet the death rate from heart disease was still less than half the national rate. So they were trying to figure out what could this be? What could it be attributable to? So anybody know the most popular course numbers-wise? I don't know how you tell popularity, but just in terms of numbers, in arguably the best university in the United States is Harvard, yeah? Yeah, Tal Ben Shachar is, of course, Israeli. He taught a class on happiness. And my wife sent me a link to a professor from Yale who also teaches a class on positive psychology and happiness at Yale, also the number one course attended in, I guess everybody's so depressed on college campus. Let's go to the class on happiness. Hey, we got more people, right? So, and it's interesting because it's a course. It's a field. It's literally, it's an endeavor that we're talking about. People are writing about it. If anybody knows, if you go to Barnes & Noble's, what is always consistently the fastest growing section at Barnes & Noble's? What's that? Self-help. Self-help. It's always self-help. When I wrote my first book, I wrote it with the intention of trying to get it into the self-help section at Barnes & Noble's. And it's in Barnes & Noble's, but they put it in the religion section. I'm like, oh, okay, great. Who's going to the religion section? I want it in the... So every time I go there, I take a bunch and I stick them in the... It's just easier, you know. Anyway, so it's called Beyond the Instant, if you want to check it out. And it's interesting because there's all of this literature and books after books. In 2008, when the happiness movement was starting to flourish in the United States, 2008, there were over 4,000 books published in the United States in that 1 year alone on the topic of happiness. And yet, study after study reveals that we are less happy today than we ever were before. And I'm going to read you a quote from Psychology Today, which is a very well-respected publication that said, and I quote, "As a nation, we have grown sadder and more anxious during the same years that the happiness movement has flourished." So it's interesting. We never had books, articles, professors in universities lecturing and studying being happy. And the studies seem to indicate at least that we're really struggling with this. And I'm going to continue the quote. "Despite our generation being more focused than ever on achieving happiness. And despite the fact that we live a standard of life that was unimaginable by our great-grandparents, just by economic standards, there are more stress-related illnesses in the United States than ever before. Right? My friend Shmuel Botech likes to use this quote all the time. He says, despite the fact that the United States is the most affluent, prosperous country in the world, we consume more than 75% of the world's antidepressants. And suicide and depression rates have gone up. And all the studies show just simply that we're not as happy as we used to be. And it's weird because it's like we have more, we're suffering less, we're living longer, we have less disease. I'm not saying we don't have any disease. We just came out of a pandemic, not just, but some people think we just did. But we
some people think it's still going on.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, we're not going there. But it's something for us to look at and see whether or not our Jewish tradition has what to say about this topic. Now, I want to rule out a couple of factors. One thing is clear from all the studies. There is little or no relationship between money and affluence. There's a lot of relationship between money and affluence. Money and happiness. The research shows that provided you have your basic needs met, okay, food, shelter, you're not worried about the next paycheck, okay? I'm not saying you have to be rich, but you're not worried about, like, not having food, clothing, or shelter. If you're living that kind of life, there more money is not positively correlated with more happiness. That makes sense? As long as you have what you need. It's pouring outside. You're not worrying that the roof is going to come in. You have enough food. You're not cold in the winter. You have clothing. You have proper clothing. You have all that. More money after that does not mean more happiness. And one of my professors, I was a psych major in college years ago, Dr. Pelkovitz, who's a great professor of psychology at Yeshiva University, he likes to say, he uses this line, he says, the man sitting on a public bus on his way to his blue-collar job is no less happy than the man riding on the road beside him, sitting in his chauffeured limousine on the way to a seven-figured salaried position. And I just saw a great article written by, I forgot the author, but he was a very wealthy guy who owns multiple homes. And he was talking to one of the Mexican workers that he had hired, you know, to do the gardening in one of his homes, and was convinced that this guy was happier than he was. And so it's not money. So what is the Hebrew word? That was fast. I didn't even have to say it. It's my book. It just appeared miraculously, like man from heaven. What is the Hebrew word for happiness or joy? Simcha. Now, I'm going to distinguish between happiness and joy, because I think joy is a little more fleeting. Happiness, I'm going to use the word happiness to refer to something more long-lasting, something I think we're struggling with, because everyone here experiences joy from time to time. You go get a massage, you buy something nice, it gives you a little joy. I'm talking about more long-term happiness. But the Torah uses the term simcha. And does anybody know when the Torah uses that term, simcha? Yes. It uses by the holiday of Sukkot, good, and actually all the holidays. Now, the holiday of Sukkot, when I say holidays, what am I referring to? Yom Kippur? Because you're like, that's not a really happy day, is it? It actually is a very happy day, but it's not. The word simcha is not used in conjunction with Yom Kippur per se. It is used in conjunction with? No. Well, let's stay on the holidays for a minute. That was very optimistic of you. What's that? It's used by Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot. What are Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot? Those are the three Shalosh Regalim, the three festival pilgrimages. Why are they a pilgrimage? In Hebrew, we call them Regalim, from the Hebrew word regal, or a leg. What do your legs have to do with Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot? You know? Because you got to use your feet to get to Jerusalem. There were supposed to be holidays when everybody, all the Jewish people, no matter where you live in the world, would go to Jerusalem, specifically to the temple, to bring sacrifices and offerings. whole families would go, or at least it would be a representative from every family. And it says, V'samachta b'chagecha, that when you get to Jerusalem, you'll be happy in your holiday. It's a song, V'samachta b'chagecha. It actually sounds very happy and joyous. And you'll be happy on your holiday, and you'll be happy. It's just two words, and it's a very famous song that nobody here knows. V'samachta b'chagecha, and you'll be happy on your holiday. It's not so famous. Okay. Now, there's another time that it mentions. It also mentions happiness in regard to being in the temple specifically. It says, V'samachta lifnei Hashem, and you'll be happy before God. It's the only time the Torah actually uses the word happiness, except it uses it in a negative, that when it talks about the rebuke that God gives the Jewish people if we don't follow in God's ways, it says, Tachas ashalo avadata et Hashem b'simcha, because you did not serve God with joy, some of these negative things will take place to the Jewish people. Hashem doesn't just want us to serve Him. He wants us to serve Him with joy. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha. It's a very famous line from the sages. To serve Hashem, whatever that means, to serve God with joy. Now, what creates this feeling of simcha? If it's really revolving around the temple, which we don't even have anymore today, we do have these holidays, but how many people go to Israel, or how many people go to Jerusalem to bring sacrifices and offerings in a temple that doesn't exist anymore? So how are you supposed to be happy anymore? What actually brought about happiness in the temple? What was it? So I want to read something to you from the writings of Maimonides. You guys heard of the Rambam? Maimonides was one of the greatest of Jewish philosophers and Talmudists. He codified all of Jewish law and organized it into 14 different books. And one of the sections is called the Laws of Yom Tov, the Laws of the Holiday. And he says the following. He says, Ketzad, how are we happy on the holiday? He says, Haktanim, children, noten lahem klayot ve'eguzim u'migdanot. How do you make kids happy before the holiday? You buy them what? What's sweets, egozim, migdanot, sweets, nuts, right? Anybody been to a shul, to a synagogue? What does every synagogue have? A candy man. It can sound a little creepy today, but growing up, everybody had every shul had a candy man. And I went to synagogue, not MGE here. We don't have a candy man. That would just really be weird if MGE had a candy man. But the guy sitting in back of me in shul 2 weeks ago, I was away for Shabbat, and he had this big talit bag, and it was not, his talis was not in it, but it was just like hundreds of like just junk that he would give out to kids in shul. Anyway, so that's how kids are made happy on the holiday. And it's not just in synagogue. What's that? Well, he went to the wrong shul. Well, you know, I mean, it's funny because we do a lot of things to enable children to associate being Jewish with something sweet. I don't know if you've ever seen this. I do this in the Hasidic world. When a little boy or girl starts learning the alphabet, you know how they do this? You ever see? They have like a chart, alphabet, gimel, dalet. And every time the child is able to pronounce the letter properly, it's a little candy on it. And they get to eat the candy. And I've been at many homes. I did this with my kids when they were little, where like you'd ask them questions about the parsha of the week. They get a candy if they answer the question correctly. It was like a lot of candy going on. And the more Orthodox religious the community, the more candy. It's just the way it works. So anyway, children before holidays were classically given some sort of gift from their parent. It doesn't have to be candy, but it's something. V'hanashim, what about the women? What do women get to make them happy? This is all written, I guess, from a male perspective. This is what a man is supposed to provide for his family. Candies for the children. And the women, it says, Kone lahem begadim. He should purchase for her clothing. The tachshitim na'im. And nice jewelry. Kefi mamono, according to his financial capacity. Mamon is money. Like, he doesn't have to break the piggy bank, but before every holiday, he should buy his wife something. Either a nice dress or jewelry. V'hanashim, what about the men? Kids and the women are very happy now. What about the guys? What do they do to be happy? Drink? Drink what? wine, good, and eat. This is very hearty and very old-fashioned, old school. V'anashim ochlim basar v'shosin yayin. The men eat basar, meat, and drink wine. Right? And by the way, he quotes the passage in the Talmud, she'ein simcha ela b'basar v'ein simcha ela b'yayin. The Talmud actually says there can be no joy unless it's associated with wine and with meat. And there's a whole discussion if you're a vegetarian, whether or not, you know, you need to eat the meat. If you are a vegetarian, because some of this is understood subjectively. Okay. Now listen to what the Rambam continues to say. U'kishuhu ochel v'shosa. When a person is eating and drinking, and he's bought the candy for his kids, and he's bought his wife something pretty to wear, and he's drinking his wine and eating his meat. And chayev lahachil lager liatam v'almana. He is obligated to feed. Lahachil is ochel's food, to give food to who? Who's a ger? A ger is a convert to Judaism. Yatom. Yatom is an orphan, someone without parents. An almana is a widow. Im sha'ar ha'aniyim ha'imalalim. Together with the rest of aniyim. An ani is a ayinun, yud, is a poor person. Ha'imalalim, or those who are sort of like down and out. And that might refer to people who may have plenty of money, but are still down and out. Aval misha noel dal tochatzeru. But somebody who has taken care of his own courtyard. V'ochel v'shote, and he eats and he drinks. Hu ubanav, himself and his children, v'ishto, and his wife. V'enu machil u'mashke la'aniyam, but he fails to provide food or drink to poor people. V'lamri nefesh, and those who are embittered of the soul. Nefesh is a soul. Ein zu simchas mitzvah. This is not the simcha. Simcha is joy. This is not the happiness that can come from a mitzvah. Ela simchas kreso. This is very blunt. He says it's just the happiness of your kreso, of your belly. This is very interesting. What is the Rambam saying? What creates simcha? So first of all, he starts off by saying taking care of your own. You have to start. You know, they say charity begins at home. It doesn't end at home, but it begins at home. So you have to start by taking care of other people, making sure that the people around you that you love are happy, and buying them, just like doing them for them, something that brings a little joy to them. And think about the other things too. What else was this family doing before the holiday? They had to engage on a long and sometimes arduous trek to Jerusalem to bring all their stuff with them, schlep the whole family, and go to Yerushalayim. And by the way, it was costly. A lot of people say it's expensive to be religious. It is. It costs money. Food for Passover costs more than regular food. It costs more to send your kids to Jewish day schools. It costs more. It costs this. It was expensive. It wasn't just like, you know. So making this long and sometimes difficult trip with your family to Jerusalem, buying something of value, getting to the temple. What did you do when you were in the temple? There were the offerings and sacrifice. I don't want to get into the whole thing right now, but that was costly. Parents would buy their children certain sweets. Husbands are buying the wife clothing or jewelry. The men are drinking wine, eating meat. They're enjoying festive meals with their family. Plus, they're sharing everything with those who are outside. The ger yatom and almana. The stranger, the orphan, the widow, poor people, embittered of souls. We have before every single holiday, you should just know, for Passover. It's called Maot Chitin, which is we raise money specifically for people that don't have the money to have the wheat for matzah. And if you look at what's happening here, what creates simcha? What's supposed to be creating simcha? It doesn't say anything about a relaxing vacation. There's no massages going on here. There's no yoga. What is it? It's literally giving to other people. This is exactly the opposite of what we're told to do when we want to feel happy in life. We usually recoil. We focus more on ourselves because after all, I must not be happy because I'm, you know, and it could be, by the way, it could be that what's making any of us unhappy at a certain time is that we're not giving ourselves the sleep that we need, the vacation that we need. It could. We might be burning ourselves out. But that's temporary. I'm not talking about quick fixes. I'm talking about long term. So much of what we do to make ourselves happy revolves around ourselves. And again, I'm not saying that these things don't reduce stress and give us some level of joy, but it's temporary. It's just pleasure. It's not happiness. And pleasure is fleeting. I used to do this just like a quick fix when, I don't know, ties were more in, not so long ago. I was a big tie guy. I love ties. And I found myself often when I was down buying a tie. It made me feel really good. And it was fast. And it wasn't so expensive, especially when you buy one on the street. It could be very dangerous if you wander into one of the Midtown stores, especially after like a fundraising. I would go on these like, I still do this. I have to raise a lot of money for this place. And I go on a fundraising meeting and it didn't go as well as I would have liked to. And I get a tie and I was like, oh, I feel a little better. Every time I'd come home with a new tie, my wife would be like, oh, sorry, because it didn't do so well. And then I put the tie in the closet and like, and it still had like a little of an effect the second or third or even fourth time I put on the tie. But after like the fifth or sixth time of wearing that same tie, it was like almost this like diminishing point of returns, right? To use the economic terminology, it's just like it did nothing for me. It did something for me, you know, and I think it's one of the reasons we shop, or some people shop, or eat, or do a lot of the other physical things that we do when we're a little down. And they give us pleasure, but they're fleeting. It's pleasure, but it's not happiness. It's joy, but it's not simcha. Simcha comes from giving to other people. And I don't have an explanation as to why. It's just the reality. It's the way I believe God hardwired us. And it comes from getting out of ourselves, which is why Judaism is so focused on not ourself, but on God, on the exact other of who we are, of getting our thoughts and our mind and our whole orientation out of our own personal day-to-day. Is this making me happy? Is this not making me happy? Is this good for me? Is this not good for me? And starting to think about more lofty ideals that are removed from my little, you know, running around myself. Doing for ourselves can reduce stress and give us pleasure, but it can't give us the kind of long-term contentment that we're all looking for. There was a great letter that I saw in one of the writings of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, of blessed memory. And he wrote this about a letter that was written to the late and great Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who was the rabbi of Chabad. And somebody wrote him this letter, and I'm going to quote. It's very sad. He said, "I would like the Rebbe's help. I wake up each day sad and apprehensive. I can't concentrate. I find it hard to pray. I keep the commandments, but I find no spiritual satisfaction. I go to synagogue, but I feel alone. I begin to wonder, what is life about? I need help." And the Rebbe wrote a brilliant response, which did not contain one single word. He took the letter. He circled the first word of every sentence, "I," and he sent it back to his student. And he said, "This is the problem." And in fact, as Rabbi Sacks continued to say, there's only one book in all of Sifrei Tanakh, in all of the 24 canonized books of Hebrew scripture, that uses the first person singular, "I." Anybody know which book? It was Solomon. King Solomon, the wise Solomon, who wrote a book called Kohelet. It's my son Yehuda's favorite book, and it's very sobering. "I built for myself, I planted for myself," he said, "I acquired for myself." No other book in Tanakh uses the "I" so many times, but that was Kohelet. That was Solomon's problem. A at least at that stage in his life, the book was all about himself and his struggle to find happiness. He was rich, he was powerful, he was not happy. And guess what they discovered when they started digging a little deeper into that tiny rural town in Pennsylvania, in Rosetta, to discover why people's lifespans were significantly longer. While there was no suicide, no drug addiction, no alcohol problems, like in so many other parts of the country, they discovered something very simple about Rosetta, Pennsylvania. It was settled by a group of Italian immigrants from southern Italy, from a place in Italy called Rosetta. They came in the late 1800s. They came as a group, and they settled there together. It was like a shtetl of Italians. And they all knew each other's names, and they all developed this very tight-knit, cohesive community. Well into the 1940s and 50s and 60s even. And they were very faith-oriented. Almost everyone in town attended Mass every Sunday. Huge amounts of volunteering. They counted 22 civic organizations in a population of under 2,000. It was a tiny town. 22 civic organizations, which means everybody in town volunteered for something. Right? And there was a tremendous sense of responsibility of one person to the next. Everybody went to Mass every Sunday. They all went to church. They all knew each other's names. And the senior citizens used to sit on their rocking chairs on their front porches. And if a kid was caught cutting school, they would all tell the principal. Everybody knew everybody. The researchers saw how the Rosettans would visit each other, how they stopped to chat with each other in Italian on the street. They were all cooking, inviting each other over all the times. How many homes had three generations living under one roof, and how much respect grandparents were given. And then something changed. And I remember this. It was called the 1980s. The 1980s, back then, they called it the me generation. Because like the 60s was like, you know, about causes and searching, and the 70s kind of like followed that to some degree. Best rock and roll came out of the 70s also, but whatever. But in the 1980s, as the new generation in Rosetta started becoming more Americanized, they started to reject the old Italian folkways. They changed even the architecture of their homes because they started getting more money. So they started focusing more on themselves. So instead of actually being able to see the next guy on his porch or her porch next door, they stuck in another garage. They had another car. And they started like not literally physically seeing each other as much. And religion went down. Not everybody went to church every Sunday. Volunteering went down. People began to spend more time on their own issues. And guess what eventually happened? Rosetta developed, like every other city in the United States, the same level of death rate due to heart disease. And this happened literally all over the country. Between the 1970s and 1990s in America, there was a marked decline in attendance in public meetings and in memberships in civic organizations throughout the country. Robert Putnam wrote a book, famous political scientist at Harvard. He called this phenomenon bowling alone. That's what he named his book. He says that even though there were more Americans bowling than ever, fewer were bowling in teams. I used to make fun of my father-in-law, blessed memory. He had one of these cheesy bowling shirts, you know, with the name on it, you know. And I kind of came into this. I was like, he's like, what do you mean everybody's in a bowling team? We all bowl. It's the way we hang out. I was like, come on, really? And the point is quite clear. And that is, we need to be part of a team. And we need to get out of ourselves. And this is one of the reasons why people who live in urban settings like New York City are afflicted with some of this in the most intense way. Because even though we live in closer proximity to each other, how many of us here know even the names of other people in our own building? Right? You can go into an elevator
And just like, you know, that awkward silence, because like you don't know who they are, and you want to meet them, and you're busy, and they're busy, and we'll do our own little thing. And that's after decades of people sort of getting used to that kind of culture. Now, I don't mean to negate other factors having to do with happiness, right? There are other factors that help produce happiness. Lower expectations, being more grateful. Gratitude is a huge aspect of being happy. But I'm focusing tonight on what I believe existentially is necessary, and that is to live as part of a community where people know your name and you care and are worried also about other people. We need to volunteer for causes in which we believe. We need to attend services so we can connect with a being that's different and other than ourselves. We need to get out of ourselves and into greater ideas that are beyond ourselves, that sometimes feel removed from ourselves. But that's precisely it. To get as far from yourself as possible. You know, I didn't want to go that far. But to get to a place where we're thinking less of ourselves and more of other people, helping other people, and more of ideas. And we need to give. Rabbi Lamb, one of my teachers of blessed memory, wrote, "The more concerned we are with our own happiness, the less likely we are to achieve it. The sages and the ethics of our fathers teach, if I am for myself, who am I? The true simcha, he says, is only attained when I lose myself, only when my concern is making others happy." And that's why the mitzvah of simcha in the Torah is always coupled with the mitzvah to provide joy to the poor, widow, and orphan. To be happy, he continued to say, we have to stop trying to make ourselves happy and start by taking care of others. That will bring true happiness. And if you think about it, Judaism is designed exactly in this way. What are the three pillars of Jewish practice? The three fundamental observances of Judaism. So, you know, when people say, oh, is he observant? Is she observant? What are they really referring to? So there's three areas specifically. Now there's 613 mitzvot, and it's not good to label people, yada, yada. But usually we talk about three areas: Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat HaMishpacha. Tarat HaMishpacha, the laws of family purity. I'll talk about it in a second. Shabbat, think about what happens on Shabbos. It's total community, right? Some people here on the Upper West Side do not see each other. And I lived here for many years as a single. Didn't see each other, talk to anyone else. Go to work, come home from work, get ready, do it again the next day. No interactions with other people. Shabbos, right? It demands that we rest, but we rest in a way that binds us to other people. Keeping kosher, you don't think it has anything to do with other people, right? We don't simply eat based on what we like, but in accordance with what we believe God, something completely other than ourselves, wants us to eat. So that the process of eating isn't just filling my tummy because I'm hungry and eating like any other animal eats because I'm hungry, but because I want to connect with something beyond myself. And lastly, the laws of family purity, which govern, and I know it sounds weird, they don't just govern, they're really there to inspire the most intimate sexual relationship between husband and wife. That helps us ensure that that relationship, that the sexual intimacy, is just as much about satisfying one's partner as it is oneself. And of course, the central role that chesed, kindness, occupies in Jewish life. It's an overarching imperative that requires us to take a certain amount of our annual earnings and give them away to charity, to help our friends when they're in need. When we go to a wedding, we don't just go to a wedding because it's fun. It's free booze and food. We're going there to actually make the bride and groom happy, to be mesamech lechatan v'kala. God forbid somebody passes away. We're going to the funeral to escort the dead. We open up our homes. We provide hospitality for strangers. That's what makes us happy. And I don't know why, because it seems counterintuitive. Because when we feel unhappy, the tendency is to, what am I missing?
What don't I have? We might actually have everything plus of what we need, but because someone else doesn't, and we're not trying to help that other person. Now, the 12 steps programs figured this out a long time ago, that if you want to help someone with an addiction or someone who's really down and out, introduce them to someone who's a little worse off and make and be their coach, right? And there's just something about that experience. And I just remember this when my kids were little. Thank you, Andrew. I remember this when my kids were little, and Sundays were like, not a nightmare, but like, I had four kids, and they all wanted to do something else. Like the one day we got to do something as a family. So this kid's screaming this kid wants to do that. And sometimes it's just like impossible to get everybody happy. So we just threw him in the car and drove to Brooklyn. No, we didn't just go to Brooklyn, but we would go to this place. It's still around, by the way. It's a great date place. It's called Masbia. Masbia is a restaurant where if a person doesn't have the... Anybody see Masbia? You know what I'm talking about? So it's a restaurant in Brooklyn for poor people who don't have the money for a meal, and they don't have to go and beg. They can just literally go in to the restaurant and be served a proper meal. So if you go as a volunteer and you can go on a date, you can go with your kids... Either they're going to make you into a waiter or waitress, or you go into the kitchen and cut onions or peel potatoes or whatever it is. And those were always the best Sundays. Because even though they kvetched the whole way there, I can't believe you're taking us to this terrible place where we could be going to, I don't know, whatever the Sunday version is of Disneyland in Manhattan is. We could have gone this. They're all yelling their desires. And instead, they did something for someone else, and the car rides back were always the best. The car rides back from Masbia were always the best because they were feeling good about themselves. We were all feeling good about ourselves. And rationally, it makes no sense. I think about my own work here at MGE. I kill myself for this place, you know, in a good way. And on the other hand, it gives me the greatest joy to work for other people. And especially that feeling of exhaustion at the end of a successful program, and you just beat, but you look at what you gave, and the same thing happens. Why does anybody? That's why, like having, like being married and having kids, is like the butt of every comedian's jokes, because it makes no sense on a purely rational level that you would pay all this money, take all of this, you know, superficial abuse. And then you're dying for it. That's all you want to do. Spend time with your family, with your kids, when it just would seem to rob or tax you of all the things you work hard in your life. But if you're very self-focused and you think that's where your happiness is going to come from, then the last thing you're going to want is a family, because they will just suck the life out of you. They will take all of your money, all of your time, all of your energies, and it'll go to some other place other than you. But people don't realize that that is the greatest way to build yourself. That's how you become the most fulfilled and happy, when you're giving of yourself to other people, not in a superficial way. That's why children are very important, because they demand giving on a very selfless, high level. That's why a lot of parents, people can't handle being, because we're not trained to do this, you know? We don't have, we don't have required army service here in the United States, where everyone, when they were 18, I mean, that is the difference between Israelis and Americans. The 18 years old is spending 3 years giving, and they're not living it up. And here in the United States, what are we doing during those same 3 years? We're in college campus party. Now, I'm not saying we're evil, terrible people. That's just what happens. But we have to look at the way we're developing as a nation, as a people, and as individuals, and then wondering why we're not so happy. And that's why the few friends of mine that actually did take over a year off to do something for someone else. I don't mean just simply travel around Europe. That's fun. That's great. Find yourself. But to truly, truly give is the way we're going to truly find joy and happiness.
I want to end with a story of somebody that I had the real zechut and merit of meeting many years ago on one of the MG trips to Israel. And his name was Yosef Nachmias. Now, the last day of the MG trip, and I'm going to do a little commercial right now because we have a nice crowd here tonight, but MG goes every year. We're going the last week. It's either the last week in July or the first week in August. July, last week in July. So there's two trips. There's a fellowship trip, and there's also the heritage trip. Both groups are together on the last day. And I try to introduce the group always to someone that's really sacrificed and really given their lives for the Jewish state. So every year we have somebody else. And one year we had this guy. He was well into his 90s. And the guy who hooked me up with him said, listen, I don't know if your crowd's going to be able to understand or even hear him because he's very old. He's Iraqi and he speaks in a very heavy accent and his English is pretty bad, you know, but he has an unbelievable story. And when I heard it, I was like, yeah, I want to hear him. We'll figure it out. I'll translate. I'll give him a microphone. I don't know. So you meet this guy, Yosef Nachmias, and he starts telling us his story. He was 14 years old. 14, he joined the British Army, along, by the way, with 30,000 other young Jews, to fight the Germans. He was from Palestine, because the British, in the Mandate, they controlled that part of the world, were preparing for the Nazis to come also to the Middle East. So they had an army, and they were accepting Jews to fight the Nazis. And 30,000 Jews, among them Yosef Nachmias, joined the British Army. And by the way, the British didn't even realize it, but they were training. Those Jews who entered the army were being trained, basically, for the Haganah, which would eventually become the IDF. 3 years later, he was 17, he joined the Irgun. The Irgun was the Jewish underground that was determined not only to defend the Yishuv, the Jewish settlement in Israel, not only against the Arabs, but the British too. And he told us that he had to purposely remove his tooth, a front tooth, and replace it with a gold one so he could better impersonate Arabs. Because you had to either impersonate the British in the underground or Arabs. And he was from Iraq, so he looked much more Arab than he did British. And there were a lot of Arabs with gold teeth in those days. So he needed to look more Arab. 17 years old, this is what he did. And he's just very matter-of-fact, just telling us these facts, this information. Starts telling us how he went on these missions to steal weapons from the British for the Jewish cause. He was part of this famous operation to break 8 Jewish fighters free from a British cell that were supposed to be hung. And I was watching him as he spoke to us. And he had this like little grin on his face. It was like wasn't like a full out smile, but it was like a little. And as he was, he had this grin as he was describing like the most stressful, painful kind of experiences that would traumatize any of us here. And he was talking about them with such pride and happiness. Because I guess as he was much older now, he was recounting his life that was really lived for something greater than himself. He helped create the Jewish state. And there's no question that his levels of stress must have been enormous. Very little physical pleasure. Lots of happiness. Not a lot of joy, but a lot of simcha. And I'm not trying to say that you need to suffer and pull out your front tooth in order to feel happy. That's ridiculous. I'm trying to make a little of a point of the associations we make with material comfort, with other types of niceties, of first world niceties, and being happy. And I think it's because we forget that we are much more than just a body. If all we were a body, then all this would make sense. But we're much deeper than that. We are a composite of both body and soul. And if we only pursue pleasure, then we feed the body. But the soul goes hungry, and we become unhappy. We have to learn to stop numbing our unhappiness with pleasures that are fleeting. And I'm not trying to say that money and things are not important. The rabbis in the ethics of our fathers said that ein kemach, ein Torah. If there's no kemach, which is wheat, which is like a very material thing, there can be no Torah. Right? You have to earn a livelihood. You have to have a roof over your head. You have to have clothing. You know, and it can be very, very stressful and a very unpleasant life if you're constantly worried where your next paycheck is going to come from. All right? And we should feel blessed if we don't have that worry. But once we have that, more money and more things may make the body feel good. They may feed the body, but connecting to God, performing mitzvot, studying Torah, coming to a class, getting ourselves out of ourselves, our brains, our minds in a different place, taking care of our family, getting ourselves into the world of ideas, into the wisdom of Torah, and devoting ourselves to other people, finding a cause that truly speaks to us, feeling like we matter to another person. That feeds the soul, and that places us before God, lifnei Hashem, as it says in the Torah, v'samachta, and you'll be happy, lifnei Hashem, before God. Right? Lifnei Hashem, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, that was before, that was when you were in the temple. But anytime you're performing any mitzvah, even if there's no temple, even if you're not in Yerushalayim, you're in New York City, but you're doing a mitzvah, you're praying, you're studying Torah, you're helping another person. That puts you before God. And that, my friends, is a recipe for greater happiness. I don't mean to say that other factors are not important. There are. I mentioned before gratitude and lowering expectations. But I wanted to focus tonight on what I think is something that we all can change in our lives. And there are some of us that I think are born, talked about this in the elevator on the way up, maybe with a happy gene. You know, people that just seem to be more naturally predisposed to being happy. They're more cheerful. They're less irritable. And others of ourselves that are not that way as naturally. So I'm not a doctor. I'm not a professional psychologist. So I can't really speak with much intelligence about that. But it doesn't really matter in my mind, because if that's not the way God created you, so we have to figure out a way of becoming more happy. And it's one of those things that we can't really run after. Happiness isn't something you can really chase. You can chase it, but it's like chasing your tail. What we're really chasing is a life of purpose and meaning. Happiness is the byproduct of a life of purpose and meaning. A life of giving to other people, a life of thinking about other people, a life of getting ourselves out of ourselves. If we live that kind of life, and as we say in Hebrew, memela, like, I don't even know how to translate memela, like, we'll just, the happiness will follow. And that's my blessing to all of us, is to try to find in our own personal lives a cause we really believe in. And it doesn't have to be like saving the whales or something like, it could literally be helping a friend who's going through a really difficult time right now, or volunteering for an organization that needs. There's so many elderly people that live in these parts here in New York City. There's a great organization around the corner called Darot. We've done a lot of work with them. They help senior citizens in the neighborhood. And just to maybe visit somebody on a weekly basis to, you know, cheer them up a little. A lot of people alone. Going to Masbia, raising money for, I will tell you as a fundraiser, it's not simple. It's not easy. And sometimes people come along and they offer to help out. Hugely helpful. So many different causes that we can be involved in. So many mitzvot that we can observe and we can keep. So many ways of really being happy. Because I truly believe that that is one of the byproducts of living a life of Torah and mitzvot. We don't do it to be happy. We do it because we believe that we want to live a life of purpose and meaning. And as a byproduct, we can please God all find a lot of happiness, or at least some more. I could keep babbling on, but if any questions or comments, please feel free. Yeah, please.
I got here late.
You heard the bulk.
I Yeah. So I didn't discuss it. The studies are pretty clear, and I wrote about it. If anybody is interested, books are for sale. You've heard much of chapter one, but there's 9 more chapters, and they're all relating to happiness in one way or another. So I have some studies in there. They all point to the same thing. The more time we spend on social media, unfortunately, and I'm guilty of this because, you know, it's easy to knock social media when a lot of our businesses are based on them, including MGE. To a large degree, we're able to get our word out to so many people because of social media. And I remember years ago when I first started MGE, we used to take out these expensive ads in Time Out New York. I think Time Out New York is still around. It's probably online now. But I remember how much money, hundreds of dollars for a little fakakta quarter page ad. And it was like double that if you wanted it in color. And now, like for nothing, we can put something out on Instagram and Facebook and get much more, you know, many more people to see it. So it's a huge blessing. But like with every blessing and every medicine, there's a side effect. And there's some pretty negative side effects, especially amongst teens with FOMO. But teens are not the only people affected by FOMO, because when you're not feeling so great about your own life to begin with, then you start seeing all of these other people's, you know, I'm going to say perceived better lives, because it's all perception, right? Nobody posts their failures. I'd like to see a new like social media platform where we can just post our failures. I think that would be a lot more comforting. And the next time you get dumped, fired, you know, or I don't know, fail on something, like you post it there. I think that would actually do better. Is that Twitter? See, I'm not on Twitter. That's my problem. Increase Facebook, Instagram usage, scrolling through all the
garbage.
It's not all garbage. It's not all garbage. There's a lot of, I listen to, you know, Jordan Peterson and all these other, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I do. There's a lot of garbage thrown in. It's a mix. It's like a cholent of like everything, you know, and.
You know what's amazing? How I was talking to a friend of mine over Shabbos, and when I was growing up, we had nothing, and we survived, and we still found out everything. So,
well, we didn't find out everything.
I found out
we did.
What did you found this class on Instagram?
Yes,
right, that's the problem. Right, I'm trying to find you the studies. Hold on a second.
But Rabbi Wild, we did find out everything years ago.
We found out, I guess, enough. We found out enough. I have it in one of the other chapters, not in the happiness chapter. But like anything else, it has to be kept within a certain boundary, because there's just it was a study I'm trying to find. It was a study, a very important study by the University of Michigan, that concluded that increased Facebook at the time and later Instagram use was associated with all the way up to like real depression. It's keeping ourselves within ourselves a little. Now you'll say, oh, it's getting into other people. It is, but not in a really healthy way. It's not helping anyone. It's just looking at other people. Looking at other people causes you to compare yourself to other people. And that is the worst way to build self-esteem, because it's not really an accurate depiction of other people anyway. It's other people looking at their best, celebrating their best moments. And that's great. That's why we get invited and we join people at their weddings and their smachot and their happy occasions. But it's like all the time, and it can make you feel like you're the biggest loser in the world. Like, oh, this person, that person. There is a thing called ayin hara. And I struggle with this. It's a Hebrew term. Has anyone heard of this? It's like, some people think it's superstition. It's not superstition. The Sfardim are really big on it. What's an ayin hara? Like an evil eye. Now, what does that mean? Yeah. Yeah, it's envy. It's really envy, which is why we're not supposed to strut our stuff. And this is, I think, another issue. And I don't know what to do about this, because our society has gone so much into this extreme. If you have it, you flaunt it.
money, your body, your this, your that, everything. If you have it, show as many people as possible. It's the antithesis of everything that Judaism teaches. Because by doing that, first of all, we lose an aspect of ourselves that's necessary. Tzniut, which means modesty and privacy, is very, very important. A, B, it causes a certain amount of envy and jealousy in other people. And it may not feel like what we're feeling is jealousy, because it might just be the sprinklings, the beginnings of what develops eventually into jealousy when we see too many wonderful things that other people are experiencing. I mean, can you imagine being told by a friend of like all the things that are going right in their life? It's like the most annoying like thing in the world. And like, how much can you be happy for another person's like, okay, it's enough. It's great. It's great. Another picture. I need to see another picture of your beautiful family. And it's not, it's difficult. The reason it wreaks havoc so much with teens, but it also moves on to, you know, is because, you know, the FOMO.
They don't know anything.
Well, there's an addiction. Although I will tell you something. When my daughter was in 11th grade, and I thought she was absolutely hooked on the phone, she brought four of her like very close friends over for Shabbat, and we were having dinner Friday night, and we were going around the table like, "What's your favorite part of Shabbat?" And one of the girls said, putting down the phone. Like, and none of them use the phone. Like, their parents basically forced them not to use the phone for 24 hours. And I was very surprised. And I was like, it must be this one girl. My daughter has one, like, angel friend, you know, who likes putting the phone down. And then all five girls together went like this. That's my favorite thing about Shabbos. I don't have to look at the phone. So we don't have to look at it at Sunday either. Nobody's telling you. It's not like you have some business. You're in 11th grade. And one of them said, you know, it's just so nice being able to talk to people without even thinking about having to capture it, send it to somebody else. You know, and I remember we were in Florida. We went away on winter vacation. I remember we were able to we rented a little fakakta boat or something. And my daughter took a picture and I saw she was about to post it. And I was like, didn't you just tell me that so-and-so, she was so upset because her family couldn't get to go away. Father just lost his job. The mother was working and he was trying to find, so they didn't have the money to go, you know. So she's like, yeah. I said, so what's going to happen? You're going to post a picture. We're on the boat looking like we're having a great time. And then your friend who's sitting back in cold New York couldn't go away. Oh, why couldn't we on the boat? She's going to drive her parents crazy. I don't know. Or maybe just be upset. She's like, yeah. And if we can have that kind of pause. Now, if you take us to the extreme, then we're not going to post anything. You know, and I'm not saying we need to do that, but we need to be a little mindful of the way what we say and what we do, how it affects other people, right? Nobody would take a wad of cash and go, made this today. I'm pretty awesome, aren't I? You know, we don't do that. But, you know, I know all sorts of things we do with the phones that would never, I remember Jerry Seinfeld was once interviewed on David Letterman years ago, and he was talking about the phone, and he says the way people pull out phones in the middle of a conversation. He's like, David, you know, imagine like you and I are having a conversation right now, and I take the New York Times and I just open it up in front of me and I start reading the Times. Like, where he goes, that would be like the height of like rudeness, right? Because it's like, well, people do it all the time. They just, right? I don't know. All sorts of things happen with the phone. Now, I'm not saying the phone's evil. I got one. I'm on Facebook, Instagram. Follow me. Okay. But the problem is that it does regret. So like anything else, you just want to try to be disciplined. Shabbos is a great way to do that. Little plug for Shabbos. Yeah, please.
I think kind of hinging off of that, one thing I struggle with a lot is like being happy for people that have things that I might want.
Right.
For me, it's more like joy.
Right, right. That's hard. That's hard.
I struggle with, and not only like feeling happy for them, but then also if I struggle with that, then I feel
guilty. Right. I'm such a bad friend. I don't even want them to be happy. In fact, that's what it says in the Torah, love your neighbor as yourself. So most rabbis don't read that literally because they don't believe it's possible to love someone else as much as you love yourself. Only one rabbi said it was to be read literally, the Rambam, Maimonides. But a lot of the other rabbis who say it's not meant to be read literally, what does it mean? It means imagining yourself in your friend's position. If you were in that position, what would you want? So if, God forbid, you have a friend who's ill, ask yourself, if I was ill, if I had what this person is going through right now, what would I want? So let's say I would want people to pray for me. I want people to visit me, call me up once in a while, see how I'm doing. So I'm going to do that for them. I'm going to pray for them, and I'm going to tell them I'm praying for them, and I'm going to visit them, and so on and so forth. That is a goal in Judaism. It is a goal. But, you know, it says love your neighbor as yourself, and the Torah is implying that you already love yourself. Very hard to love other people when you're struggling with your own sense of self. And we all do on some level, and that's okay. That doesn't mean we're like, oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. But we should try, I think, to focus. And I just did, I have a little WhatsApp chat if anybody wants to join. It's called Beyond the Instant. It's named for the book. I do like 3 recordings a week. My recording literally this morning was one of the advantages of learning to focus on the soul part of you is that you can be a better friend. You know why? Because you know what separates us from each other? Our tastes, our interests, our cultural backgrounds, just all the material, physical, superficial things of who we are. I'm not saying they're not important when I say superficial. But what's the one thing that's the same about us in everybody else? And that is our soul. The godly soul that exists within us, the Kabbalists teach, all initially emanates from God himself. And therefore, in that sense, we're all the same. And that's actually a way just to contemplate and to reflect on that and to think of ourselves as being connected to other people through our spiritual essence, our souls, can help us be better friends to other people and maybe feel a little better for them when something goes their way. Because, you know what really makes a simcha? I went to a wedding yesterday. A friend of mine who is divorced, and I really had a rough time in marriage and in life, and got married, and what makes the simcha, what makes the joy, it's not the fancy caterer or the photographers or the flowers. Again, those are just, it's seeing the people who are sincerely and genuinely happy for you. There's nothing, you know, when you can be happy for another person, but it does imply that you are good with you to a certain degree. And the better you are with yourself, the more you will be able to be there for other people and be a good friend for others. But it's not so simple, you know, to be good with ourselves. And I think that, again, going back to my main thesis tonight, my main message to you is to try to do something great for others and connect ourselves with something beyond ourselves. And I'm not saying, oh, I'll start doing that, I'll just start feeling happy altogether. No, but when you're pursuing a more lofty goal in life, the byproduct is the happiness. If you shoot right for the happiness, it doesn't happen. Yes? Yeah. So I think therapy is, it all depends what the issue is, obviously. And you want the right type of therapy for the, depending on the issue and your personality. You know, sometimes behavioral might be more effective for a certain issue than, let's say, psychoanalysis. I'm a very big proponent of therapy. I don't feel like everyone has to be in therapy all the time, but I do think it's important. And I don't, we live in a day and age where there's thankfully almost no stigma attached to it anymore. There used to be, I think, more of a stigma if a person has a therapist. But if you want to grow personality-wise and you want to grow in terms of your own happiness and self-development, you know, you want to have somebody that you can talk to that's objective and that you can be honest with. And that's one of the great powers of therapy is that, you know, you might have a friend who's like a really good listener and a friend who's smart and maybe can help and has your back, but you don't necessarily feel so comfortable sharing everything, you know? So I'm a very big believer in therapy. But there are a lot of situations, and I'm sure many of us here have been in therapy for a long time and haven't seen much progress too. That can happen. And sometimes one therapist might be really good on one situation or for one stage of your life, but not really good for something else. So we shouldn't be afraid to kind of change it up. I think for some people it's absolutely necessary. And I do believe that there are some marriages that could have been saved with better therapy or different therapy. I've had that frustration sometimes with couples who feel like that, you know, that there was no way of saving this. And sometimes there isn't. That's why the Judaism allows for divorce. But often a good therapist can save the day or help save the day. But it's like, you know what, it's almost like physical therapy. My back went out, I had to go for physical. Every time I went there and my physical therapist asked me if I did the homework during the week and I didn't do the homework during the week, they said, look, I'll work on you, but like, you know, I tell the same people also, we have one-on-one learning every Wednesday night from 7 to 8 if anybody wants to come. But if you're learning how to read Hebrew and you expect to be able to learn Hebrew from your 7 to 8 o'clock session, 1 hour a week, and you don't practice during the week, you know, unless you're really good at language acquisition, it's not going to happen. So a lot of times therapists get blamed for not being effective when the couple or the individual is not doing their homework. And that's really important. It's a great question. Any other comments, questions, critiques? Tell me why you think I'm wrong. What else do you think produces happiness that I haven't shared? I don't want to want this.
Drugs.
We're trying to get away from the temporary happiness, you know, going for something a little more permanent. Yeah. It's literally existential, and I can't tell you that most Americans don't have it, but a lot of Westerners don't have that, and it's very where you actually have a place where you go, and people know who you are. That's what the Jewish community was always meant to be, and most Jews who grew up in the United States don't have that. They attend their synagogue a couple of times a year. It's not a regular thing, and if it's not regular, then it's going to be very hard for other people to really know when you haven't shown up. That's when I knew MG, by the way, was a real community, was when a woman came over to me and said, do you know that so-and-so lost her job about a month ago and she's been out of work for a month? So I said, I had no idea. So the only reason she knew is because this other person was coming and then you're schmoozing at the kiddush and you're hanging out and then people know. But if you don't come often enough, if you don't show enough, you're not going to matter enough to other people. Not because you don't matter, but because you're not, you know, it's like out of sight, out of mind. You're not involved. And I'll tell you, this is a problem in the American Jewish community. It's a big problem. And people then try to find their community in other ways. You can have a community at work, but I don't think it's the same. I don't. And a lot of people are very close to the people with whom they work. But it's not the same, in my opinion. So I would say most people who come to MJE, a lot of people are coming, you know, because they want to learn more and they want to grow spiritually, and that's great. But I would say more people come here to have a sense of belonging. And that's one of the reasons we're here. Not just MJE, any Jewish community, really. It's really, really important. So I encourage people to do that. That's why, by the way, I was giving these types of talks during COVID at nausea, because COVID was like it's pretty clear what happened during COVID. We were forced to be separate from each other. And then people got used to it. And people were not coming back to their synagogues and their communities when COVID was over after the vaccine or the second, the booster, it was like people just started getting used to being on their own. That's not a healthy thing to get used to. Now, too much of anything is not good. You know, always being around other people, not having a sense of privacy and a sense of aloneness that sometimes is unhealthy as well. But I don't think we suffer from that as much. And I think COVID really brought a lot of people into not a great place. There was nothing we could do. You know, there was nothing we could do, but I'll just leave you with one last story. If anyone else has another question, we were trying to figure out what to do on Passover for the Seder. So many people were alone at their Seders. So I called my friend, he's a rabbi, Yonah Bookstein in California. He's a dear rabbinic colleague. And, you know, Zoom was a godsend. Zoom is unbelievable. I don't think it was so great on dates. Has anybody Zoom date here during COVID? Anybody Zoom date? I was encouraging people to Zoom date because it's better than no dates. It's better than not interacting, you know. But there were just so many, you know, elderly people who were alone. And we try not to, you know, open up our laptops on Shabbat and not operate electricity on Shabbos. And the rabbis were trying to maintain that as much as possible. I was telling people, like, if someone was really down and out, God forbid, depressed, do what you have to do. Put the TV on, keep the laptop on, talk to people on the phone. We were carrying our phones on Shabbat during COVID, some of us rabbis, even though we don't do that, because people were really down and out. But we figured out a way. We didn't want to institutionalize the Zoom thing on Shabbos. We were concerned that it would just stay, which, by the way, it's happened in other parts of the Jewish community. And now when people can come back, they're not coming back. They're staying on Zoom. That's really unhealthy, in my opinion. And it makes it 10 times harder for the community leaders to build community. So they're 3 hours earlier in California, in L.A. So I asked them, I said, would you do like a Seder 3 hours before Passover for all the New Yorkers? And then we'll just tell the New Yorkers, put your laptops on before the holiday starts. Keep it on. Put it on the dining room table. Because I knew so many people who are literally alone. Elderly people alone. And single people alone. They want to go home and infect their parents or vice versa. People were calling me. And we had about 400 to 500 people on that Zoom Seder. And I can't even tell you, like, he did a three-hour, Yonah Bookstein did a three-hour Seder until he had to turn it off, and then start his own real Seder with his family. He said it was the most exhausting Passover he's ever had. You know, Seder's are long to begin with. But it was such a beautiful thing for people to feel at least connected, even virtually. But it's not the same, and no one should ever presume it's the same. That's why I didn't Zoom tonight, by the way. People keep asking me to Zoom, because I know I'll Zoom it for someone who's out of town or someone who's not feeling well. But if I just Zoom regularly, people who live around the corner from here won't show up. They'll just pop open their laptop and come on Zoom. And that's not healthy. It's really not. We need Aristotle. We're social animals. We need to be around each other. So anyway, that's my message for happiness. Any other comments, questions? Yes, please.
Happiness actually called your son's song, you know, which was about being in the moment. Because I think that what reduces happiness when they're in
So that's that the song, he wrote that song to be able to, because when you're not in the moment, it's very hard also. That's another factor, by the way. Give a whole other talk about trying to be present. And I struggle with this because I'm a multitasker in the phone, but it's just not as pleasant when you can't really just look at someone and be there with them. It's also very disconcerting to the other person, and it knocks away at the relationship. Being in the moment. One of the lines that he has in there is that there's a place within us that can help us be in the moment always. And that's the deepest part of who we are. Because that's always in the moment. That's our soul as well. I'll tell him you shared that. Thank you. He'll appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah. What's your name again? Say again.
Jacob,
yeah.
So you spoke back from LA?
Yeah.
What is the meaning, I guess, at the end of that story in regards to
Solomon? Right, so I'll start with the second. We very much believe in free will.
And if you don't, it's hard. Because if you don't, then either you have the happy gene or you don't. Because if you don't believe, you have no control over your actions. You have no control really over your own disposition and psychological state of being. And that free will is just an illusion. Then you're going to have to just sort of play out life. Play out some part that's already been pre-scripted by someone else. And it's very, very hard to find happiness in that because you can't really affect your own happiness. You either have it or you don't. If you really believe in free will, as Judaism very much does, and that we can, you know, we can't control everything that happens to us in life, but what can we control? Some of you heard me say this before. We control how we deal with things that happen to us in life. Rabbi Soloveitchik always said that. That we can't control the circumstances of life. Life happens. Stuff happens. You get fired. You get whatever it is, but I still have a choice as to how I'm going to deal with that difficult and challenging circumstance in my life. I can get overwhelmed by it. I can get depressed through it, or I can somehow learn how to deal with it as best as I can. And even at some point grow from it, because the greatest growth always comes from challenge and adversity. That's the Hebrew word for miracle is a nes. What's the Hebrew word for a challenge? Nisayon. It's the same word. Because what's a challenge? How do we grow? We grow because things that we didn't think we were capable of doing, we thought were beyond our ordinary abilities, that are extraordinary, that are supernatural, if you will, and then we do it and we push through it. That is how we develop ourselves, through adversity, through challenge. But you gotta believe that you have that power. If you don't believe that you have the power to affect that kind of change over your own life, then you unfortunately will be destined to simply react the way you are pre-programmed evolutionarily, biologically, psychologically. Now, don't misunderstand this. We believe that we all have different predispositions, different temperaments, right? Some people are more easily angered, hotheads. Some people are very blah. And nothing bothers them, or less bothers them. I'm not saying we're born the same. We're not. We're all born with different temperaments and dispositions, psychologically. And the great Maimonides wrote this. But that doesn't mean that those dispositions and temperaments control you. They just make it challenging for you one way or the other. So if you are more easily angered kind of person and things set you off very quickly, it's going to be a little harder for you to deal with certain situations, life, and someone else. But remember that that other person has a different challenge that you don't have. You might be more easily angered, but you're also, I don't know. You're more of a, by nature, generous person. So when you're asked to give something from yourself, it's not as difficult of you. You don't mind sharing the things that you have. So everybody's got, we all come with our makeup. But within that makeup, we can affect change. And if you believe that, then that's a huge, huge tool for happiness, because then you can deal with anything. And I'm not saying that doesn't make life simpler or easier, but it makes life a manageable, and we can even grow eventually from it. But you have to believe that you have that power. The first question you asked about Solomon was interesting. Solomon went through a lot of different stages in his life. He also wrote the book, I believe when he was younger, called Song of Songs, which is poetry about love. And he seemed to be in a very different place in his life at that time. But this book of Ecclesiastes, that's the fancy English word for Kohelet, he seemed to be in a place where he was quite successful, quite powerful and wealthy and affluent, but was very seemed to be very unhappy. And he himself even lost himself at one point, spiritually. He took on too many wives. Rabbis teach, took on too many horses, literally. He had too much, and it was not serving him. He was serving it, which happens. We all think, everybody wants like the life of the rich, lifestyle, the rich and famous. We all want that. We say, yeah, we know it doesn't really make them any happier, but we all want it. We do. But it's probably more challenging. Just look at Hollywood, look at the most beautiful, talented, wealthy people in this country. Some of the most miserable people walking the face of the earth. And I'm not saying that with any glee. It's a terrible thing. I wish only joy and happiness on anyone, especially with people with such talent. But don't think because of those great circumstances that they have, because of their awesome looks and their money or their power of fame, that that in and of itself is producing happiness. They're just different qualities, and it all depends on how you deal with it and what you do with it. And again, if you are totally self-absorbed with it, and it's all about you, and you don't get yourself into something greater, you can be as miserable with all the money in the world. And you could be someone who is on the lowest economic totem pole, who's working for a guy who's working for a guy who's working for a guy who has all that money, and you're happier. Because you're happy with your family, you're happy with your lot, you don't have a lot of money, but you have enough. And, you know, and I told you that story on the outset about that very wealthy guy who owned multiple homes, you know, who started talking to one of the workers, one of the Mexican gardeners on his property, and he was convinced that this guy was happier than him. And it might be true. That doesn't mean the rich guy can't get happy, and it doesn't mean that the gardener can't become miserable, right? It's just a question of how you deal with the reality, with the circumstances of your life. Great question, Jacob. Yes. That takes a lot to learn to trust Hashem that what we have is enough. That's very difficult, especially because we live in a country that's teaching us always to get more. Always, you know, to be ambitious, to have drive, and we should be ambitious and we should have drive. But why is the ambition and drive always for material success? As though that's what's going to give you, it's such a lie that we've been sold. That the more material success we have, the happier we're going to be. And by the way, please, Judaism is not about being poor. We don't subscribe to that. We should be very proud of the success, the material success that we have in this country or any of us has. That's a beautiful thing, but nobody should mistake that as the recipe for happiness. So if Hashem did not bless us with the ability to make a lot of money, we should not be angry with God because we think that God has deprived us of the ability to be happy. Okay, in fact, he's deprived us the great Ramchal, Rabbeinu Moshe Chaim Lutzato, taught that every person's life predicament is their challenge. A rich person is tested to see if he or she will become indifferent to the plight of the poor. And a poor person is tested to see if he or she can become satisfied with what they have. And it does come down to trusting Hashem that he knows what he's doing. It often doesn't look that way on the surface because we react the way we react. But if we could have more trust and we could see the circumstances as just being different parts of reality that we have to learn to become and embrace as opposed to fighting against. Now, if you're poor, you need to fight against poverty. And if you're sick, God forbid, you need to fight against the disease. Don't get me wrong. But I'm talking about someone who's not, someone who's healthy, please God, and someone who has enough money to get by just fine. That we shouldn't think that by putting more of my eggs into the wealth management basket, that's what's going to ultimately produce more joy and happiness in my life. What it does produce is more challenge. It produces more challenge to be able to find happiness amidst the physicality. So it's a little tricky. It's a little tricky. But the good news is we may actually have everything we need to be happy in life. Now, I'll leave you with one last thing. I'm sorry. I know I've said that like 10 times. Wow, it's late. I kept you guys really long. I'm going to finish with this. Why do we start?
Enjoying. Keep going.
I hope you're enjoying. I don't know. Why do we start our prayers every morning with the Brichot HaShachar, with the morning blessings? Thank God that I can see. Pokeach Ivrim. Malbish Arumim, that God gives me clothing. But I don't know I have clothing. I don't know that I could see when I open my eyes in the morning. Why do I have to say a blessing when I come out of the bathroom? It's a weird blessing to make a bracha when you come out of the bathroom, that all the plumbing is all working okay in there, you know? That's a bracha that we say, Asher Yatzar. I have it right outside the bathroom over here. It's transliterated. You can say it if you'd like, if you go to the bathroom. Why do we do that? Don't I know the plumbing is working? Of course I know, but I'm not aware of it. And when you're not aware of your blessings, guess what you end up doing? You start chasing other things that you don't have. Because if you don't think you've got what you need to be happy, you're going to look for something else. But most of us have everything we need to be happy. We just don't realize those things because we become so numb to them. It doesn't do anything for us. And then when do we start appreciating it? When it gets threatened. We're all the same. By the way, I had a hernia operation, I don't know, 10, 11 years ago. They don't let you leave the hospital until you, it's going to be a little gross, until you move your bowels, go to the bathroom. So I remember like waiting, finally it happened, and I was like, wow. I made a Asher Yatzar blessing like I'd never made in my life. That blessing. It meant something so because it was threatened. But why does something have to be threatened for us to appreciate it while we have it? I mean, that's what happens in this country also. We spend our whole lives trying to make money, then by the time we have enough money to enjoy it, we can't even enjoy it so much because we're not in the same health. It's crazy the way we live. We have so many blessings. So gratitude is a very, very important thing, not just, you know, not just saying it like it's a nice thing to be grateful to other people. Gratitude forces you to acknowledge things you already have in your life that should be making you more happy than they currently are. But because we fluff over them, we don't think about them, we're on to the next thing. It must be something I don't have. And I'm not saying not to be ambitious and not to go for something that you don't have. We always should try to do that. But if we can start with what we have, you know, Eza Ashir, who is a rich man, Hasamech Bechelko, he was satisfied with his lot. We put that on my Zaidi's tombstone, my father's father. He was the poorest man I ever knew. My father's father lived in a little small hick town in Pennsylvania, had a little store. We never knew how he earned a living. I don't know. But he was a very satisfied, happy person. He provided for his family. They didn't have a lot, but they had what they needed. And, you know, and to me, he was poor. To me, because by most of our standards today, he was poor. But he was a very rich man. He was a very happy person. So I think we need to take a pause, look at our lives, start counting our blessings. And we count our blessings. By the way, it's not enough to just hear it in a class. You actually have to say the blessings. Hear yourself say it. Tomorrow morning, wake up in the morning, open up a prayer book. You can take one from here. If you want, they're outside on the table outside. Just grab one. Morning blessings. Start your day every morning by saying, thank you for letting me see. Thank you for letting me stretch. Thank you for this clothing. Thank you for just the little simple things in life. And if you're aware of them, it will make you happy. And just going about our day, it will help you put other things into perspective. So gratitude is a whole other way I didn't go tonight, but that's a very important thing as well. Thank you for bringing that up. All right, I don't let you guys go. It's late. We're going to continue. This is a four-week series, and we've got some guest speakers coming in the next 2 weeks. Ellie Sullivan is speaking next week and the week after, Allison Reich from our staff, and I'm going to be teaching the week after it. So stick with us every Monday night for this amazing series on happiness, and have some cold pizza. And if anybody would like to buy a book, you can speak to Andrew. Is that okay, Andrew?
There's a QR code here.
Oh, that's your name. You can take a book and just do $20 on the QR code. Thank you. So nice to see you. How are you doing? Okay. I know, right? I know. I'm actually going to Israel next week.
Oh, you are?
I'm so excited. My kids. I miss them.
Two are over there, right?
Three. We're going to Europe. We're stopping off for a couple of days in Spain. I'm so excited.
Really?
Yeah.
You're in Spain.
Yeah. We're going. Oh, we turn this off so the whole world is.
You don't want to record our conversation.
I hope this recorded. It was on here. We're going to Barcelona. I've never been, but the Ramban was from there, and I want to go see where he was from.
Cool.
Yeah.
That would be so awesome.
I know.